Hello, we are Angela Benjamin
and David J. Lilly,
and we are both jewellery designer makers who spend every day surrounded by shiny things.
We are both passionate about jewellery
and love learning all we can about jewellery making and sharing what we've learned with you.
Perhaps you're a jewellery lover or creative type, or spend your days at the bench like we do.
Whichever it is, we hope you'll enjoy our sparkling chit-chat, our silly stories, and our thoughts on living a creative and slightly dusty life.
With a few laughs along the way.
You can find our podcasts on all your favourite apps, including, of course, the biggies, Apple, Spotify, and Chrome Podcasts.
So if you want to know who we are and share our passion for all that glitters, then stay with us for the next 30-ish minutes.
This is
Ange
and David with Little Gems on Jewellery
and Life.
Hello. Today, this is Ange flying solo again for Little Gems on Jewellery. And I have another guest who I'm really excited to chat to. I'll be speaking to Russell Lounsborough, who is a goldsmith specialising in wax carving and miniature sculpture. Is that right, Russell?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Is that right? Brilliant. I know Russell through my studies at Morley, and I've recently been doing quite a few of his classes, including mount making and wax carving. So hopefully you'll be able to find out a bit more about Russell and how he got where he is now. So Russell, if you want to kick off by telling me, how did you get into jewellery making?
Well, it was either luck or fate, really. I kind of lost interest in school during my A-levels and subsequently failed them all. Didn't really know what to do with myself after I had left school. So I picked up a local newspaper, and there was an advert for a local college. I waved my hand around over the top of it and jabbed my finger on the paper, and it said silversmithing. And I thought, I wonder how you do that. So I started doing one day a week alongside, you know, local apprentices that are going there, the local cutlery and silverware firms, this up in Sheffield, of course. So there's a lot of that there. And I kind of enjoyed it. My first day, I remember quite well, the apprentice sat next to me. I'd cut out this disc of copper to raise up into a bowl. And the tutor told me to find it. I didn't really know very much about it. And I was finding it across the edge of the piece of metal instead of following the shape round. And the apprentice next to me said, are you deliberately trying to ruin that piece of metal? And that was my first experience. Silversmith, as you know, takes a long time. When I say silversmith, I mean proper silversmithing, brazing, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Not what a lot of people call silversmith these days, which is making jewellery out of a piece of silver. That's completely incorrect. It's actually goldsmithing, even if you are working in silver.
Right.
Anyway, so while I was there, there was a lot of people doing jewellery. And so I was watching them, and it took me an entire term to raise a bowl. And they were making several pieces of jewellery during that time. And I thought, I think I'm going to switch. And so I did that. I did complete my City and Guilds craft level and advanced craft level. But even after I'd done that, I felt like I didn't really know that much. I mean, my mum was an antique dealer, so I was very familiar with the work of people like Lalique and such like. And I'd look at pictures of their work and think, well, how do you possibly make that from bending a bit of sheet and making little settings up? It's impossible. So I knew there was a lot more I had to know. One of my mum's neighbours was a university lecturer at Sheffield University and said, oh, you know, they do degrees in jewellery making, which was kind of mind-blowing. You know, the concept that you could do a degree in jewellery just like seemed impossible to me. You know, that was always supposed to be like academic things, you know, like science or language, literature, all that kind of thing. So I looked around, I applied to Middlesex University, went down for an interview, which is the most humiliating interview I've ever had.
Why?
Obviously, I didn't know what an art school was like at all. I had no idea. Okay, I've been hanging out with apprentices. So I thought, well, I probably better dress a little bit smart. So I put a suit on. I didn't bother with a tie. I didn't feel like I was that keen to look conformist. Not that going to an art school for an interview, I thought I had to look conformist, you know. So anyway, I turned up, I taught myself to do some paint-ups from Sylvia Wick's jewellery making manual, and I got various pieces that I'd made on my City and Guilds course. I walked into the interview room, and there's that big hall area near their canteen, and there's all these tables set up, and all the other students, they had these enormous, huge, stuffed portfolios full of artwork. And I had like six little A4 sheets of paper with paintings and jewellery on it, and not a shoebox, it was smaller than that with a few pieces of jewellery in it. And I looked around, I thought, oh, this is going to be bad. And gradually they took all the students off and interviewed them, and they came back right at the end of the day. I've been standing there the entire day, and they walked up to my table and went, we think you need to learn a bit more about art.
So had you been interviewed?
No, that's all that happened. My day, and then said that to me and just walked off.
That's awful.
Subsequently, I discovered that you should do a foundation course, and so I applied to three foundation courses. I eventually ended up going to Sheffield Polytechnic to do theirs, and I had a fantastic interview, and fantastic and quite unique interview.
Wow. There. Unique how?
I went along and, you know, obviously I thought I'm going to have to do some larger artwork, so I did several pieces of larger artwork, again using the same techniques that I'd used for painting out jewellery, but just painting larger things on bigger bits of paper. And then I took a lot of it back. Shame this isn't going to be a visual interview, because I can show you a bit. I can show it to you now.
Yeah, sure. And you can even describe it. That'd be great.
I was in the interview, and the guy who was the head of the department, Trevor Faulkner, said, oh, what are these? A couple of hammers that I'd made on my City and Guilds course.
You made those hammers?
Yeah. And I said, oh, I made them.
Why?
And he goes, what? You made those hammers? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I've never, ever had anyone come to an interview with hammers that they made themselves. Well, your artwork's fine. I would probably give you a place on the strength of it anyway, but I really, really wanted to see what somebody who makes their own hammers does with my foundation course. And as soon as he said that, I thought, I like your curiosity. This is the kind of place where I think I need to be.
Yeah.
And I was right. I did my foundation course, loved it, had a great time, and learned a lot about art, failed my art A-levels, add to my other three failed A-levels that I already had, and applied to Central St Martin's and did the interview there, got a place. I went round to have a look at the place, check out all the colleges, and CSM had the most lovely old benches in there, and the building is beautiful, and the attitude of the students was fantastic. So I thought, this place I'm going to go. So I applied there, decided that I wasn't going to even bother looking at anywhere else or have a second choice, and told the interviewers that if they didn't give me a place, I'd just be back next year and the year after and the year after, until I eventually ground, and they gave me a place, and I got a place, and went there for 3 years, had a great time, graduated in 1991, and I just won an award from the Royal Society of British Sculptors, and they gave me a bunch of money. I spent a month in Japan, going around looking at sculpture and Netsuke and all them carved items that I found really fascinating. Got back and set up a studio with three friends. We all chipped in 20 quid each, bought a bit of timber and built some benches in there. Everything else in workshop we salvaged out of skips and repurposed and fixed up, because we all had no money. So yeah, and that's it.
So in college, you pretty much went straight into working for yourself.
Yeah, in some ways I kind of regret that, because I think there's a lot to be learned from working for somebody else, and you gain a lot of connections. I was kind of lucky because I had a specialist skill, which was kind of rare, so I got a lot of people interested because of that. And I bumped into somebody, an American woman, who was just had a workshop above Mullin, who was just starting her. Well, she'd been doing it for a few years, but she wanted to make, she was doing body piercing, and she went on to open a quite famous shop called Into You, and she wanted somebody to make body piercing jewellery in gold, because nobody was doing it. And so she thought, I asked her, well, why are they doing it? What problems they encountered? She told me, and I instantly knew how to solve all those problems. So I started doing that part-time and carving people part-time, and then doing a bit of my own stuff, and putting it in a few shops and galleries. In between that, I managed to get enough money together to live on that for a month. During that month, I found enough work to sustain me for the next month. And that's been going on since 91. So what was that? That's 32 years, is that? Something like that?
You found your niche very early on, and it's kind of worked for you, really, hasn't it? Because it's very special. Yeah. What you do.
Yeah, because I'd go to various different casters as well as a carver and drop my work off. So anyone that's looking for somebody to do some carving, perhaps their caster, you know, that does this, that, or the other. And so they'd all get passed my way. There wasn't a lot of us around in those days. Maybe half a dozen in London.
So again, quite a small pool. You mentioned earlier about wishing this had visuals, because yeah, I do too, because I can see your studio. We're on a Zoom call doing this interview, and I can see Russell's studio, and I'm always already very curious about it. But can you describe your studio space in a bit more detail?
Well, these days I work from home, but for 25 years I ran workshops, shared workshops with my colleague Danilda. Built three workshops over the years before we finally decided we were sick of running workshops and constantly having to find people to take spaces in them. They're all great looking studios, really. I feel it's important. If you're going to spend a lot of time working in a place, you might as well make it look good. Now, at least as enjoyable to be in as your home, because you're probably going to spend more time there than you do at home anyway. When I started out, I was doing 6.5 days a week in my workshop. And in fact, at one point when I didn't have anywhere to go, we had to move out of the place we were living in. I actually lived in there for 3 months as well. So,
literally a home from home.
Yeah, I don't have as much equipment as I used to. I used to have a lot bigger equipment. These days, I like to keep everything down at quite small sizes. But what is most important to me is it has to be tidy and well organized, as you can see.
I'm loving your little storage boxes. Things like that make me anxious because I'm so messy.
I need to know exactly where everything is. My bench is kind of like it's all playing a piano.
Right.
So every single note is, so I can just automatically get to it.
Wow.
Anytime looking around for things, I use a tool, I put it back where I stow it. It's very, probably sailors recognize that kind of neatness, I suppose.
You fold your apron at the end of the day as well, do you?
I don't actually wear an apron, no, but I do keep a go with the Hoover, especially if I've been carving wax, because that gets everywhere. This bench here, you can see I've had that since 2004. Started off quite basic, and then I've built bits onto it here and there and added to it. So now, it goes up a bit, kind of like an upright piano, I guess.
So a place for everything.
It's a magnetic knife racks there. I've got my engraving tools attached. Lots of drawers. I know what's in every drawer. Nice piece of the cabinet with everything.
Right.
Little drawings instead of, like, I don't write what's in the drawers. I make little drawings of what's on the drawer.
And it looks like you've got loads of light coming in as well. Is that something that's obviously you've got detailed work?
Yeah, good light's important. Have a good seat as well. I'd sit on an office chair so I can adjust the height. So different jobs that I'm working on, I might want to sit so I can keep my posture good. I've been in an osteopath so many times over the years. It's really important to have good posture and make sure your seats are the correct height.
You're watching for a physio, Russell, so yeah.
Oh yeah, very important.
Very important. I like that. I like the fact that you put that in there.
And, have a good light, because, you've got one set of eyes. Don't waste them trying to ruin them, trying to see things that you can't see properly. If you need visors or magnification, use it. Don't strain yourself. I've got LEDs in there in my overhead lights, which aren't on at the moment. I've got daylight bulbs.
Right.
And I've got a big window there, which I'm all the curtains are over, because it's a bit too bright for the screen here. But
so everything you've got is purpose, really. It's purpose built. You've got everything installed that you need as a jeweler, which is really important.
And every time you get more of an idea of exactly how you want your bench space to be, is now constantly moves files from one side to the other. So I think maybe slightly more efficient. Saves me an extra half a second reaching over there and reaching over there.
So what are you working on at the moment?
Sure, a lot of my work is I can't actually discuss it because obviously I'm working with a lot of different designers. In fact, finding time to pursue my own stuff's quite hard sometimes. Like, that was a little doing a little charm of an hour over there, which I'm about one third of the way through, which I started in January.
Right. And that's one of like your own personal projects.
Yeah. That said, I am going to go and do Goldsmith North. So I have made up another sort of six or seven pieces. But it's kind of some of my older stuff that I've just redone in gold. So I have found time to do that. It's not like I've started an entirely new carving and gone through the mold making. I've used old molds, so it saved me quite a bit of time. I had to make a few components for them.
And so for our international listeners, Russell, because we do have a few, I've been told. So Goldsmith North is the northern version of the Goldsmith Fair that happens in...
That's right, yeah. And it's in Sheffield as well. So my hometown, it'll be the first time my work's been in the Cutler's Hall in Sheffield since 1987.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. So that's quite exciting. We're going back to where you started.
Yeah, I'm going to take a photo and put it on the display of me in 1987. You can see a bit of the jewel in the background. You can't see it very well because it's a bit too far back. But I'm holding a cup from the Sheffield Assay Office, which I won an award there in 1987. I was the first person not employed by a local company to win that cup, which is why on the cup, my name's engraved. And next to it, there's a blank space where the company's supposed to be.
Wow.
Normally, it's only one of my apprentices that.
Finally, props to you. So you must have been still a teenager then?
23.
Right, okay. Yeah. And so lots of our listeners will probably know you more so through the book that you've written on wax carving. What made you decide to write that? Where did that come from?
I was invited. Brian Hill from the Goldsmiths Craft and Design Council had just written a book on silversmithing, the real silversmithing, now bowls, cutlery. Yeah. I can't remember when I bumped into him, and he said, oh, do you want to do a book on wax carving? Because I've won quite a few awards from the Goldsmiths Craft and Design Council. Yeah, okay. So he introduced me to Crowwood Press. And I've been teaching since wax carving since the mid-90s. And it seemed like a good time to put all that experience into words and pictures and share it with a wider audience. And the best reason, of course, to write a book is because you've got something worth sharing. Don't write a book if you want to make some money. Because it doesn't really make that much money. We don't have huge sales. If you want to make money, write a cookbook.
Yeah, or a crime novel or something.
You know, my parents are getting very old, and I thought it'd be quite nice to have something like this to show it to them. Unfortunately, during the time that I was writing it, they both died. It ended up taking 4 years to write it. I was supposed to write it inside 1 year, and my uncle died, and I kind of put it off for a little bit, and then my mum died. And again, I didn't feel like writing. And then a year after that, my dad died and I didn't feel like writing. And then finally, on top of that, we lost our lovely workshop in Hatton Wall, which has been my favourite workshop we've ever had, so property developers. And then the landlord in the place we moved into after 2 years decided he wanted to triple the rent. And it was at that point that Danny and I decided that we weren't going to run workshops anymore. We just started renting space for other people until COVID started, and then we both started working from home. So writing the book was quite difficult. We're finding the right words to convey meaning and then marry it up to the pictures, select the correct pictures because you've got a limited amount of space. You've got 25,000 words. We're allowed 250 pictures. We ended up using 440 pictures, and they allowed us to do that. So, yeah, out of the nearly 5,000 pictures that I took, I had to pick the best ones. And
that was quite important, that editing of the pictures, because jewelry is such a visual thing. And I know myself personally, that's how I learn. I have to see something, right? Reading instructions just doesn't work as well for me. So,
and then we've got to like edit down from like, you know, I have 30 pictures for one project. And to be realistic, we probably maybe have 12 or 15. So then I've got to pick, okay, now which one best explain, go with the explanation that I've made to convey what I want to say or what people are going to read and understand. And you're kind of guessing a lot of that in a way, because you don't really know until someone reads it, whether it's going to work or not. And, you know, I mean, so writing took a long time. We were very conscientious about the quality of the content because we didn't want to just chuck out any old rubbish because it's our names attached to it. It's kind of our legacy. We eventually, COVID came along, which was a bit of a bonus because I had nothing else to do, so I had to finish the book.
I think you and a lot of other people.
And then we emailed it off to the publisher, and we were overjoyed after being fobbed off for various things for 4 years while we got round to doing it. And then it came out. We're still in the middle of COVID, so we didn't have any launch parties or book signings or any of that kind of stuff. It just came out, and it went on to sell 6 times as many copies as was projected for its first year. Somebody described it as an important addition to the canon.
Definitely. And also probably it coming out during COVID was a good thing. People on lockdown having time to actually do something and read a book and study. It was perfect. And that probably contributed to it being a success.
This year, somebody at the Goldsmiths Crafts and Design Awards taught himself from my book. So he's had like 2 years.
Wow.
Gold awards, a nice level, you know. So yeah, we described it as that taking you from complete novice to intermediate, but looks like it takes you from complete novice to master if you're applying sound correctly. No book can make you a master. It has to come from you.
So what's your greatest fear when it comes to making, going back to the sort of practical side and handball?
Easy one, breaking a stone.
Oh, really?
That would be the worst thing, you know. If it's a client stone and it's something fragile, you know, sometimes you work on something and there's this little clicky kind of noise, you know, the stone's chipped. It happened to me with something that somebody brought me a ring to repair and a bloodstone. I thought, oh, yeah, totally safe that stone is. But the ring had been run over by a car and it was crushed from it. So I had to knock the ring, 9-carat gold ring, back in the shape. 9 carats, very hard. I nailed it loads of times, put this bloodstone in, started setting it and pushing down on the last little bit to just get the edges over. And there's this annoying, cracky noise and it just shattered right across the middle. It's like a whole trench, broken stone in the center. Pretty unexpected. I didn't really expect it from that, to be honest, but I could replace it for him. And yeah, breaking it stone, it's the worst thing. That's why I don't like the fragile stuff like emeralds and opals. Always take that to a setter, let them worry about it. You know, diamonds and other rubies, sapphires, they're nice and easy, don't need to worry about them. Cheap stones, doesn't matter. It breaks, just smash it and put a new one in.
And so flip side of that, then what brings you the most joy when you make?
Sometimes you can just be working on something, you get totally in the zone and it's like a meditation, become kind of unaware of your own existence or the passage of time or anything. And it's just a really deep focus on the work that just kind of materializes between your hands. I find that intensely pleasurable. I really enjoy that.
So what other creative, living or dead, give you inspiration, both in life generally and in your work?
Well, in terms of jewelers, I'm a huge René Lalique fan. René Lalique is the greatest jeweler that ever lived, better than Fabergé, better than Cartier, better than any of them. Superb work. A huge fan of Georges Fouquet, who's contemporary with Lalique as well, another great Art Nouveau jeweler. Living, I really love the work of Kevin Coates, or Dr. Kevin Coates, I think you might prefer to be called. I admire the work of Gerda Flockinger, all that reticulated stuff. I think it's great. It's completely unlike what I do, which is one of the reasons why I love it. It's really easy to love something that's completely unlike your own because you never compare it. So that makes that really easy. Another jeweler like that is an American guy called John Paul Miller. I think he might be dead. Do a search on him. He does these lovely sort of kind of Klimt-like sea creatures. I think it's probably the best way to describe it, I think. But yeah, great, great work. I love that. Lydia Corte does some really fascinating things. And I've always kind of liked Wendy Ramshaw. I think what she did with all that lathing stuff up and very futuristic looking jewelry was great. Artist wise, I absolutely love the work of Patrick Woodruff, who's an illustrator from the 1970s. I love Alphonse Rucker. Again, that's Art Nouveau. Other illustrators, temporary illustrators, I kind of like a lot of that, such stuff like Rodney Matthews, Ian Gibson. I like a lot of stuff that's come out from comics, illustration you get from the Victorian era, you know, Edmund Dulac, Arthur Rackham, all those kind of people. I like sculpture, particularly Antonio Canavath, possibly one of the greatest sculptors of all time, responsible for the Three Graces, which is currently in the V&A. Go and check it out. It was saved for the nation by the National Association of Decorative and Fine Arts Societies, of which my mum was a member. She took part in the campaign to save that.
But I think I'm going to have to get a list of those off you, Russell. We'll put them in the show notes.
I take a lot of interest from Art Nouveau and Baroque. Baroque is probably one of the peaks of human artistic endeavor. It's so complex and rich. I don't really like a lot of modern things that are very young. It's all about the lines or abstracted things. I like people who can really sculpt and really study nature, really study form, and then turn it into something completely new and unusual. And that's what fascinates me so much about work of Dalí. You know, his most famous piece, The Dragonfly, part woman, part dragonfly, but a huge dragon claws on it. And it's this mishmash of this hybrid creature made from other things, but they all look so perfect and natural together and beautiful.
Brilliant.
Yeah, much better than just a piece of bait wire.
That's the end of part one of my interview with Russell Lounsborough. If you want to hear more, download part two.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode and come back to us another couple of weeks for the next one. In the meantime, also thanks to Alfie Amadeus for the amazing track, Octopi, which is our theme music. See you soon. Bye-bye.